الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. أتمنى أن الله to proceed إن شاء الله. We're going back to the series about women in Islam. And prior to the interruption, we went over Kirana, or the leadership of men, and what it means. And we said that we always talk about, you know, clarification as far as what it means to us, because sometimes we may have the wrong concept or wrong understanding or wrong implementation. So we need to clarify it to ourselves first, what it means to us. And we need to be able to persuade, therefore clarification and persuasion. The persuasion is twofold. One is by the textual proof, which applies to Muslims, and one is by ratiocination, or reasoning, or logical, juridical extraction, juridical, logical arguments, which is applicable to non-Muslims. The non-Muslims in this case will be atheists and people who subscribe to a particular religion. With atheists, you will really concentrate on ratiocination, but the people who, although you will still mention the comparison with other religions, with people who subscribe to other religions, you will have more focus on the comparison than ratiocination. But you will still use ratiocination, reasoning. And so, quickly, the which we have gone over before in the previous talks. We started with, you know, the introduction, and we talked about the clarification, ratiocination, and comparison, and as an approach, and we talked about why compare, and we talked about the rational argument. We gave a simple introduction about the women in the Quran and the position of women in the Quran. And then we have a comparison between women in the Quran and in the Bible from, you know, the very beginning, which is the concept of the eternal sin and the fact that the Quran did not make the woman the culprit. In this case, and it was Adam and Eve. It was the sacred Adam and Eve, and when one was mentioned, it was Adam and not Eve, versus the biblical story, which makes Adam innocent and Eve is the one who tempted him. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived wasn't a transgression. And then we talk about the Ecclesiasticus, and so, you know, and I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart, this is part of the Bible according to anyone aside from the Protestants, but all of the classical Christian religions, Orthodox and Catholics, would actually consider this to be part of the Bible. Ecclesiasticus was actually called Ecclesiasticus because it was the most preached in the church. It was the most frequently preached in the church, Ecclesiasticus. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. Whoso pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh or seeks, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. So basically there is no righteous woman. The comparison is in the ayah here. Verily the Muslims, men and women, the believers, men and women, the men and the women who are obedient, the men and women who are truthful, the men and the women who are patient, the men and the women who are humble, the men and the women who give sadaqah, the men and the women who observe fasting, the men and the women who guard their chastity, The men and the women who remember Allah much with their hearts and tongues, Allah has prepared for them forgiveness and a great reward. I think the comparison does not need comment. Here, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the gift of giving a female child to the parents, and on the opposite side, it is said that the period of impurity that the woman has to observe is twice as much for the female infant versus the male infant, as in Leviticus. And we give a brief comparison between public imprecation, that's when a man accuses his wife of adultery, between the biblical version and the Quranic version. In the biblical version, there will be uncovering of the woman or her head. She will need to drink the water of curse, and she will need to be told all of those deterring statements, versus the Quranic version, in which he will make his four or five oaths, and she will make her five oaths, and then she will override him. If they conflict, she will override him, and her innocence will be declared without having to drink anything, water of wrath or water of curse or anything, without also having to be uncovered, etc. And, you know, comparison for the divorcees and the widows. In the Bible, it says that to marry a divorcee or a widow is a source of disgrace. This is Leviticus 21:13. And he, which is a priest, shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman, or profane, or an harlot, these shall he not take, but he shall take a virgin of his own people to wife. In the Jewish tradition, is there, it says here in the Arabic, but that has not been translated yet. فَلَا يُبَنِسْنَسْ لَهُ بَيْنَ شَعْبِهِ لِأَنِّي أَنَا غَبِّ الَّذِي أُقَدِّسُهُ, so that he does not disgrace his offspring amongst his people if he marries a divorcee or a widow. The issue of freedom of expression, I guess, or something. This is Timothy 2:11-15. St. Paul's advice to the Corinthians. He says that let the woman learn in silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. Verses in the Quran, Surah Al-Mujadila, the debater, the woman who came and debated with the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala supported her argument in Surah Al-Mujadila. The women of the enemy, and in Numbers 31:17-18, now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that has known man by lying with him. But all the women, children, that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. This was attributed to Moses to have said to his followers about the captives of war. In no Quranic statement would you ever find the killing of the little ones. In fact, you'll find the prohibition of killing the little ones in the Sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, as well as the prohibition of killing the women, as reported by Nasa'i, that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam naha an qatl al-shaykh al-kabir wal-mar'a wal-sabi wal-asif, that he prohibited the killing of the old, the young, the woman, and the non-combatants in the army. This one says that, you know, anyway, I'm sorry I didn't translate this yet, or didn't find it, or I did not get a translation. The translation must be there. But this, anyway, this is, again, Ecclesiasticus, and it talks about that every pain is tolerable but the pain of the woman, and every evil and wickedness is tolerable but the wickedness of the woman. Okay, and then we talked about the issue of inheritance, and we covered this and why half, and we talked about instances where the men and women get equal shares, and instances where she takes more, instances where she borrows from the men. But when they're equal and they're the same, we talk about why the half. And we say that this is applicable with the son and the daughter, but it's not applicable with the father and mother for reasons that we mentioned. We talked about the testimony of the woman and why half the testimony of the man in the prescribed the financial transactions. And we said that her testimony will be double that of the man in childbirth, certain cases where her knowledge will be more valuable than the man's. And we talked about the education of women, and we talked about the leadership of men inside over their household. And we said that there's got to be a hierarchy. There is the impossibility of having any institution without a head. There's got to be a hierarchy. Otherwise, an institution that has no head, like a company with no president, or a plane with no distinction of roles, pilot and co-pilot, is certainly a setup for disaster. The same applies to the family. But it does not mean tyranny. It means consultation and so on. But it means regulation so that eventually there is some hierarchy, some structure, and some capacity to come up eventually with a decision. Now, we'll talk about the hijab. And the first thing that we need to address is the comparison. The comparison. Then because Reishi is a nation, without the comparison, you will be going up a hill. But if you compare first, sort of push the opponent back, and then give the rational, logical argument, that is certainly the way to go. So first, because the opponent may be Christian or Jew, but completely unaware of what the Gospel or the Torah has. So to bring this to light first is important, and then you talk about the logical arguments and the rational proofs. For instance, the issue of the hijab, here in Genesis 24:64, or chapter 24, verse 64, it says that Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she alighted from the camel and said to the servant, "Who's the man walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself. That is a face veil, by the way, and covered herself. That is not even hijab only, that's niqab, face cover, burqa. In the Corinthians 11:3-10 here, it says, "But every woman that prays or prophesies with her head uncovered, she dishonors her head, for that is even all one as if she were shaven. For that is even all one, that's the same as if she was shaven." To uncover her head is the same as if she was shaven. So she is not allowed to pray or to prophesy without her head being covered. For if the woman be not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head. For as much as he is the image and glory of God, the woman is the glory of the man. So the man is the glory of God, and the woman is the glory of the man. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. So the man is from God directly. The woman is from the man. Therefore, she is not the glory of God. She is the glory of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. And don't think that this is not, don't think that this is not applicable in our science. In fact, I have a patient of mine whose father tells them that women were created for our, you know, fun. So that this is coming from here. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman was created for the man. For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the sight of the Lord. So at the end, he will say that they're equal in the Lord or in the sight of the Lord, the Rabb, or in the Lord or in the sight of the Lord. So, but all of this does not really, you know, does not really concur at all with the last statement that they are equal in the sight of God, because she was described as not coming from God, man is coming from God, she's coming from the man, she's not the glory of God, therefore she has to cover her head, but the man does not have to cover his head because he is the glory of the image of God. And that's again what we call anthropomorphism, because they're trying to say that the man is, that God is like a man, but a big man. And that is anthropomorphic. Because here it says, for a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. So God is a big, you know, omnipotent big man. And man was created in, you know, literally in the image of God. So, this first one to tell you that, well, it is not Islam who brought this ruling, and you. This has been something that has been practiced before Islam. This is what God revealed in every religion. What does this tell you? It is the superiority of the Islamic explanation of why women need to cover. What does Allah say about why women need to cover? يَا أَيُّهَا النَّبِيُّ قُلْ لِبَنَاتِكَ وَأَزْوَاجِكَ وَنِسَاءِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ يُدْنِينَ عَلَيْهِنَّ مِنْ جَلَابِيبِهِنَّ ذَلِكَ أَدْنَى أَنْ يُعْرَفْنَ فَلَا يُؤْذَيْنَ. O you prophets, say to your wives, your daughters, and the believing women, or the women of the believers, to bring down, to lower down their garments. That is so that they may be known as chaste and not harassed. So that they would be known as chaste women and not harassed. So the explanation here is to protect the chastity and the dignity of the woman, because by wearing her hijab, she's telling the man that she is not for sale, that she is not for his pleasure, you know, that she is a human being, and, you know, it's obvious, it's known, that if a woman is covered, the man will not be looking all over the place. Because honestly, you do see, when that is not the case, the man would be not very focused in the discussion on the subject matter of the talk or the discussion. And this is proven by studies. Now, it's just not a matter of anecdotes or a matter of, my own preferences, but this is proven by studies. Okay, so here, this is not a new thing. The hijab is not a new thing, but the explanation that the Quran provides is for protection of the woman, chastity and dignity, and that is the explanation that's provided in the Bible, in St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians, that this is because she suffers because she is the image of the man, or the glory of the man, and he doesn't suffer because the image and the glory of the Lord, which is not the case. According to Rabbi Menachem, like Menachem Begin, but it's not Menachem Begin here, it's Menachem Breyer. According to Rabbi Dr. Menachem Breyer, in his book, The Jewish Woman in Rabbinic Literature, he said, was the custom of Jewish women to go out in public with a head covering, which sometimes covered the whole face, leaving one eye free. Okay. So, when did they quit doing that? They quit doing many things during the time of Napoleon. In fact, there was a Jewish reform movement during the time of Napoleon that called upon the Jews of Europe to align themselves with European culture and way of life, and forget about the customs of the East. Forget about the customs of the East. This is after, you know, hundreds of years of being in Europe, of living in Europe, and forget about the customs of the East. Well, you know, we can't help but say, well, Ibrahim is from the East, Isaac is from the East, Jacob is from the East, Moses is from the East. So to align ourselves with European culture and customs and give up the East, that is giving up Ibrahim and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and Joshua and David and Solomon. All of them are from the East. So just keep in mind always that, you know, the difference between Islam and other religions, why Islam takes so much heat from the secularists and the media and this and that, is that Islam did not doubt. That is basically it. Islam does not bow, and didn't bow, and wouldn't bow. But this is not because those rulings are very, very peculiar. Those rulings have been present in the previous books, as you see here. Okay. Now, the issue of polygamy now is another issue that needs to be addressed. First, let's go over a little comparison. This is Deuteronomy here, chapter 21, verses 15 to 17. It says here, if a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he makes his sons to inherit that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. So this is just an exhortation to be just. You know, the firstborn is the firstborn, whether he is the son of the beloved or the son of the hated. So if the son of the hated is the firstborn, be just and give him, you know, your inheritance. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. Okay, Genesis 16:3, and Sarai, Sarah here. Sarah was called Sarai as well, but, you know, the more popular is Sarah. Sarah, Abraham's wife, which is another pronunciation for Abraham, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abraham to be his wife. You find a little bit of conflict here in the Bible, because sometimes they call her a wife and sometimes they call her a concubine. And in fact, they base the fact that it was Sarah's children, the chosen, to be to inherit the prophecy and prophethood, because Ishmael to them was an illegitimate child. Illegitimate because he was born to a concubine. Well, historically that is untrue. The kids who were born to concubines are not considered illegitimate. Again, the Bible itself contradicts itself, because sometimes we call her wife, sometimes we call her concubine. But anyway, and certainly that story is full of holes, right? You know, the fact that Abraham was asked to sacrifice Isaac, your only son, that's a big problem here, because the Bible itself says that Ishmael was 14 years Isaac's senior. So Isaac was never his only son. And if he wants to say that Ishmael is now a son, the illegitimate son, the Bible is full of, as for your son Ishmael, I'll multiply his seed, a great nation shall he beget, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is the second book of Samuel, chapter 5, verse 13. After he left Hebron, David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to him. You have to understand, well, David had 100 wives. Solomon had 300 wives and 700 concubines. David, whether we call him king or prophet, that is not the issue here. Because many times I see some of our brothers, they get stuck. Because, you know, they use David and Solomon only to prove, you know, why are you picking on Prophet Muhammad? David and Solomon also. Well, guess what? It is not just David and Solomon. It's also Moses, and it's also Abraham, and it's also Jacob. So don't be stuck here. But secondly, when the rebuttal to this is, David and Solomon were kings, because they don't call them prophets, they call them kings. Okay. First of all, well, was David a good person or not a good person? In fact, David is the only begotten son of God according to the most ancient manuscripts. Because the most ancient manuscripts, the popular famous verse, for God so loved the world that he forsook his only begotten son. That word begotten in this verse was an interpolation. According to the most ancient manuscripts, it was not found. Therefore, in the newer versions of the RSV, Revised Standardized Version, it was taken out. There's no begotten there. Therefore, who's the begotten son of God in the Bible? According to the most ancient manuscripts, David, as in the Psalms 2:7 here. I will declare the decree, the Lord has said unto me, that's David, thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. You are my son, today have I begotten you. Today you're a son, today have I begotten you. So David is, according to the Bible, the begotten son of God. And David has a very, very special status in the Bible. So call him king, call him whatever you want. But that is not the final, that's not your final rebuttal. The final rebuttal is, did David convey a message from God? Yes, the Psalm says David's book, right? So he conveyed the Psalms from God to humanity. That is what we're saying about the Prophet Muhammad. Forget about the word prophet. We actually use messenger, because messenger for us is bigger than prophet. So if you're saying the Prophet Muhammad, since he married nine, he can't be a messenger, in other words, he can convey a message from God, why is David conveying a message when he married 100? Why is Solomon conveying a message? The signs of Solomon. Why is Solomon conveying? The signs of Solomon is the Bible, the Word of God, conveyed by Solomon. Why is Solomon, who married 300 and had 700 concubines, a good candidate for this? when someone, but keep in mind, the difference is huge, because both are nine predominantly widows and divorcees and so on, and older women. And for David and Solomon, they were of the, you know. But at any rate, the argument is, did they convey a message or not? If marrying more than one is a disqualifier from conveying a message, then Abraham is disqualified and Moses, everybody is disqualified. But if you say, no, maybe two or three is fine, but nine is too much, okay, then Solomon should be disqualified, then you're lying against God by interpolating the Songs of Solomon in his book. And David should be disqualified, and you're lying by interpolating his Psalms in the Bible, because he should be disqualified, because if nine would disqualify, 100 should, you know, to any fair-minded person be a disqualifier as well. So this is the issue of polygamy as far as the prophets are concerned. In the second book of Chronicles, chapter 11, verse 21, the name is Rahbaam in Arabic. I don't know how they say it, Rehoboam or something. Loved Makkah in Arabic. I don't know how they say it in English, but also how they pronounce it. Makkah. Daughter of Absalom in Arabic, Absalom, more than any of his other wives and concubines, and all, you know, he had 18, etc., etc. So there is no, and this is the thing about Napoleon here, according to Charles Rubinstein, polygamy was practiced by the Jews until the declaration against polygamy of Sanhedrin in Paris, convoked by Napoleon in 1805. He says it was an emphatic assertion the Jews have discarded the Orientalism of the past and were in full accord with the culture and civilization of Western Europe. So the Jews decided to side with Napoleon here on this, and sort of discard, which is a very harsh word, the Orientalism of the past. So the legacy and heritage of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and Joshua and David and Solomon, that is the Orientalism of the past. He also maintains that it remains a well-tolerated privilege of royalty amongst Christians. So not only the Jews were polygamous, but Christians were polygamous as well. See the established and maintenance of socially imposed monogamy in Western Europe by Kevin MacDonald, Department of Psychology, California State University, Long Beach. Okay, so now here is this is from the viewpoint of comparison. You have to bring this first. Comparison. Now, ratiocination. The issue of polygamy from a logical perspective. First of all, who are more polygamous, the Muslims or the non-Muslims? The non-Muslims. Because the incidence of polygamy in Muslim countries is 2%, 3%, in some countries higher, in some countries lower. And we're not saying that it's a bad thing at all. Certainly not. It's the legislation of the Lord. So, but we're saying that who is truly more polygamous? It is non-Muslims, because the incidence of infidelity here in America is what? So you can have all kinds of numbers now, but you know, people say anywhere from 50-70% incidence of infidelity. That means you know, people are not treating monogamous here. The only difference is, and those scandals that sort of come to the surface every once in a while, this is what is coming to the surface every once in a while. But what is not coming to the surface, you know, this is like, you know, they find the culprit. sort of to torment Tiger Woods or, you know, Bill Clinton or something. So, and then everybody starts to act very virtuous and very, you know, noble and virtuous and so on. Like Newt Gingrich, when he was attacking Bill Clinton about his affair, it turned out that Newt Gingrich had a birth affair with a secretary. And he's the one who's acting very, you know, how could he dare do this? So at any rate, the issue of polygamy here, the non-Muslims are more polygamous. But the difference is, when the Muslims, when the good Muslims, because there are some bad Muslims also that are polygamous in the same way, but when the good Muslims practice this, they preserve all the rights of the woman. So it's more of a burden on the man versus going out and doing whatever he wants without any liability, without any obligations, without any consequences. He's taking a burden on himself being married to a second wife who will have rights, and her kids will have rights, who can take him to court and get, you know, nafaka and, you know, make sustenance from him and this and this and that. So he's bringing a lot more burden on himself when he could have been able to do whatever it is that he wanted to do with mistresses. So had it been just, you know, a response to excessive virility, he could have done this with mistresses. But he's taken so much burden upon himself, so much liability, so that he preserves the right of that woman. Also, if you talk about the issue of polygamy here, did I tell you about this question that came to me on my fatwa about the man who married his wife, and he married her, and after 5 months of marriage, she was diagnosed with leukemia. And then for several years, he has been with her, and his family I think he lives here, but the sister is from Pakistan or something, and he brought her and this and that. But his family is trying to convince him to divorce her because, you know, son, well, for how long are you going to live like this? Which is really difficult, you know, for a man to be married but not married for several years and taking care of his sick wife who is in chemotherapy and so on. So the parents, out of, you know, parents are old. You know, this Egyptian family, this Egyptian lady, she said, she was talking about her two kids. And she said, my daughter had a perfect marriage, or has a perfect marriage. My daughter has a perfect marriage. Her husband does everything for her. He cleans and he sleeps and he mops and he washes the dishes and so on and so forth. But my son had a terrible marriage. His wife makes him clean and mop and sweep. So it was perfect. That's the double standard. Like, as a parent, you want your son or daughter. Doesn't matter, son or daughter. But you want your son to be comfortable. You want your daughter to be comfortable. So you don't have one. It's just, you use your double standard. And parents do this, except if they're, you know, pious and sensible. But at any rate, so the parents were trying to tell him, he can't live like this forever. The solution for this fellow is to marry another woman. The solution for this fellow, I'm not talking about a legal perspective, whether he lives here, but if he lives in a Muslim country under Muslim law and so on, the solution for this fellow is to marry another woman so that he will have his needs answered. And these are not only biological or physiological needs. These are also emotional needs, social needs, you know, social and emotional needs and so on. what's the biological and physiological need? So you have his need fulfilled, and at the same time, he does not need to divorce his wife, particularly when she is in this predicament. Even because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, وكيف تأخذونه قد أفضى بعضكم إلى بعض وأخذنا منكم ميثاقا غليظا. And how do you take it when you have conjugal relations with each other and they have taken from you ميثاق غليظ. ميثاق غليظ is strong covenant. Allah calls the tie, the knot of marriage, strong covenant. So you don't break it easily like this. So this strong covenant with this lady, honor it and help that lady as much as you can, even in her terminal disease, and at the same time, get married so that you have your needs also answered and fulfilled. What about, you have to get ready for all types of, if you're in the debate, you have to get ready for all types of things. What about flipping the argument? What if the man is sick? Why can she go and marry another one? Well, she'll have the right to leave that man. If the man cannot fulfill her needs, she will have the right to leave that man. If she is patient, then that's great. But there is a difference here. There is a difference here. Have you ever seen in the history of humanity stable customs in any nation where one woman keeps several men in her household? No. No. There has not been in any nation, polygamy where one man keeps many women in his household. That has been known throughout the history and throughout the nations, even the Christian monarchs in Europe, the Jews of Europe, the Bible, all over the place. It has been throughout. But the opposite is not true, because it is obviously not possible. Not only because of the issue of how do we figure out the child, whose child is this, which is also one of the valid issues, one of the valid factors, but naturally it is not. It is not part of the human general inclination. It is not part of the woman's inclination. And a woman will not be able to handle this. A woman will not be able to handle having several men either. So you can't flip the argument. It is obviously not possible to flip. Not only in the history of humanity and throughout the nations, and if you go back and study anthropology, study sociology, and you'll know that this does not happen in the human family, but even expand it to a whole genus. It doesn't happen in the animal kingdom. It doesn't happen. Now, if it happens with certain insects or certain this or that, that is obviously not the rule, but the exception. And after all, even with bees, is it going to be several male bees or one? It will be one. At the end of the race, it will be one mating with that queen. Anyway. So the first thing is the women who get sick. The woman who gets sick. You know that Christianity was split apart because of this issue? Because honestly speaking, Martin Luther, despite his ideas that could have been popular in Europe at a certain point of time, I think without Henry VIII, Martin Luther would have not made much progress. So Henry VIII, the king of Britain, is what gave that much steam to Protestantism, because the Pope would not allow him to marry a second wife. Well, he is not allowed to divorce his first, and he is not allowed to marry a second. So he left Catholicism and, started his Anglican Church, basically. So it would have been very easy. Well, keep the first one. He was saying that she was unstable, Henry VIII. he claimed that she was unstable. People said that she was stable. There is this agreement. If she was unstable, keep her and be good to her and marry another one. It would have saved Christianity. But didn't happen. So that is one issue. The other issue is, and this is not the only, you know, the woman who's unstable, the woman who, multiple things happen. What about the woman who's barren? Well, someone may say, what about the man who's barren? Well, she can go marry another one. But it is not feasible to marry, to have two men in the same household for a woman. But what about the woman who's barren? It's not as easy. By the way, when we talk about disease also, the man can take loneliness more than a woman. So the man who's sick may be served by his sister. You know? And if he's sick, he will not mind who serves him. And if it is a sister, if it is a mother, if it is an aunt, extended family, it's something that is emphasized in this time. And if it is the community, if he's sick, he can be served by anyone. But if the woman is sick, after spending 20 years in this household, it is very, very hard for her to go back to her parents' household, even if that is still existent. Even if her parents are still there, her parents are still existent, it is harder psychologically for her to go back and be served by, you know, her in-laws and sister-in-law or something of that nature. So it's quite obvious. The differences are quite obvious. But the barren woman is different from the barren man. The barren man, the woman may have the right to say that this hurts me, I need to have a child, and leave that relationship, if it is actually hurting her. But the barren woman, if the man divorces her, and I'm not saying it's harmful for the man to divorce her, but if the man divorces her, certainly that's a big psychological setback for that woman. So it is kind and honorable and virtuous of the man, if he really wanted to have kids, to go ahead and marry another woman and have kids and keep this one as an honored wife. What about the societies where women are much more than men? Well, this is not certain peculiar societies, by the way. This is just the default. The nature of things is that women will be more than men. There will be more women than men in any society at a given time, or almost any society at a given time. Now we have the 2010 census. Will be exciting to, you know, America may be a little bit different because of the immigration. Usually males will immigrate, not women. But traditionally in old societies, and if you look at stable societies that are not immigrant societies, you'll find that the number of women exceeds the number of men. And it sometimes exceeds the number of men by millions. And I don't have the statistics now, but in certain European countries, it sometimes exceeds by millions. Now, those women, so if you match one man to one woman all over, you know, the world, those extra women, what's going to be their, what alternatives do they have? The surplus is there. Look at the statistics. There is surplus. The surplus becomes more manifest after wars and things of that nature. Because after World War II, 60 million people were killed in World War II. 27 million in World War I. Promiscuity in Europe became the way it became, or, the, you know, took that much, made that much progress in Europe because of the surplus of women after World War II and World War I. It was one after the other. The surplus of women, you have millions of women who do not have husbands. So what are their alternatives? To be nuns. Celibate life, celibacy for the rest of their life. Is it doable by, you know, large numbers of women or people? he could always argue and be stubborn and say, yes, it is doable, why not? But it didn't happen. You know? He can always argue and say, yeah, wine, we can have social drinking, we can take care of it, I never get drunk. I said one or two cups of them. But, from a communal perspective, did it ever happen? Was any nation capable of taming the beast of wine? Name one. Didn't you try in the 1930s to prevent wine? You know, and this was a very wise decision on the part of the Congress, by the way. In the end of 1920s, 1930s, they tried to forbid wine. They couldn't. But it was a very wise decision because they understood that this would be behind all of this homicide and suicide and emotional breakdowns and, you know, mental anguish and so on and so forth. Let's stop it. Let's prevent it. They couldn't. So if you tell me, yes, I can, you know, social drinking, you know, everybody can take care of this, I will tell you, show me when did it happen. Give me an example. On a communal level now, the same applies to the issue of celibacy. If you say, I prefer for women, and this is the feminist. I would live my entire life without a man. Whoever needs a man? I would live, and I would recommend this for all of my fellow women or feminists. Well, did it happen? Why did it not happen, if that was possible? So celibacy is out the door, because even if it was an option for a woman or two or some women, it's not an option for the millions of women that will not have husbands if you match one man to one woman. Now, so what is the other option? So if you have three options only, you have celibacy, you have promiscuity, be a mistress, and you have co-withery. That's it. You don't have many options. Choose one of three. Celibacy, co-withery, having sex outside of marriage. So which one is more honorable out of the three? Be realistic now, because the surplus of go to the statistics and see what the statistics say about, you know, the number of women and the number of men in various countries and censuses in various countries. And now tell me, those women, those hundreds of thousands of women, what option would you prefer for them? Celibacy? Or co-withery? Or promiscuity? And choose one of the three. And that's how you corner the opponent in a debate. Okay, next, what about the man who is not fulfilled with having one? That may be a little stretching, this, right? The opponent here will tell you, no, you're going a little too far now. No, I'm not going too far. Because this way, you have to understand that when men reach a certain degree of celebrity and power, and wealth, and everything is at their fingertips, except that he cannot have more than one wife. That is the most pressing and urgent and demanding desire God inculcated in the human. Well, some people can manage it and have one wife and be fine. Some people cannot. Particularly when they reach a certain level of wealth and, you know, status and celebrity and this and this and that. So Kennedy, for instance, was not able to stay with monogamous. Because Kennedy was a young man in his 40s and president of the strongest country in the world. And although Jacqueline was his dream come true girl, that he was not able to. The same applied to Clinton. And, you know, the same applies to many, many people. You know, Tiger Woods, for instance. So in this case, and instead of you ruining the life of another woman, marry her. Don't ruin her life. Because Lewinsky, whether she became popular or not, or she made a lot of money or not, But then it's just like an awkward thing. Like she would be like, I don't know. It particularly in a society that puts emphasis on chastity and honor and dignity and so on, you would have ruined the life of that woman. So instead of ruining the life of other women, get married. And then the issue of is there no polygamy in the West. So I think that this should be enough. And next time, inshallah, we'll talk about the issue of concubines. Because that's another big issue. So I'll call you, 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 I'll call you